Today we're going to start a new series for the next 2 weeks. Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam, the laws of repentance of the Rambam. We'll start with the second chapter where he defines what tshuva is and talks about how to apply it. Depending upon how much ground we cover, I may get back to the first chapter and deal with the more theoretical legal aspects. I should remark that although this is the Mishneh Torah, which is the Rambam's legal work, still he includes a great deal of philosophical material when necessary, and especially in the laws of tshuva, where he has a discussion of free will and God's foreknowledge and human responsibility in the world to come. A great deal of material above and beyond just the bare bones of tshuva. I don't think we'll get to much of that because it's very rich text. But we'll start with the second chapter. Now, I will read you through the first two laws because they need to be understood in the context of the other. And then we will discuss them in detail, phrase by phrase. And I'll do the translating on my own, although there are translations of this text. In my view, they have their ups and downs. The Rambam starts. Eizo hi tshuva gemura. What is complete tshuva? What is complete tshuva? Now, the attentive, critical reader should already have some alarm bells ringing. You haven't told me what tshuva is yet. And you start by asking what is complete tshuva? Wouldn't it have been more reasonable to first give me the basic definition of the concept and then tell me what complete tshuva is? And I think that intuition is correct. Indeed, in the second law, then he will define what tshuva is. The second law starts, Umahi ha-tshuva, and what is tshuva? So he's quite aware of the fact that he's starting in an order that's not the usual order of presenting an idea. So, what is complete tshuva? This is when comes to his hand. In other words, he has the opportunity concerning what he already violated, the crime he already committed, and he's able to do it. And this time he refrained and didn't do it because of tshuva. So a second time the reader says, wait a minute, we're defining tshuva, aren't we? How can you define tshuva by telling me he didn't do it because of tshuva? I don't know what tshuva is yet. Correct. We'll get that into the second halacha. Again, the order is funny. But anyway, tshuva is some kind of reform. And complete tshuva is when you have the opportunity to do the exact same crime over again. And this time you refrain, but not because of some external impediment, but because you've decided to reform yourself and not do that sort of thing. Not from fear and not from lack of strength, but because of reform, let's say. Ketzad, how does this work? What would be an example of this? Now he's quoting a Mishnah from Yuma. He had illicit relations. And after some time, he was alone with her, and he still loves her, and his body is strong, and he's in the same Medina, which can mean city or district, where he transgressed, and this time he refrained and did not transgress. That is a person who's called a Baal Tshuva Gemura, a master of complete tshuva. I'll make a few minor comments here. First of all, the Rambam is very specific. The same crime means in all details. It's the same woman, not just a sexual crime, it's the same woman. And he still loves her. if he no longer cares for her, it's not the same crime, it's not the same temptation. And he's physically strong. And it's in the same society, because when you move from society to society, the pressures and the ramifications of the action could be entirely different and change the psychological dynamics. No, it's got to be in the same society. And this time, he didn't do it. That person gets a title, a master of complete tshuva. And as we'll see, he has two more lower gradations which have a different description. And here I want to point out something that's extremely important. So to be a master of complete tshuva, you have to be under the identical conditions of the previous crime, and this time withstand the temptation. Does that mean, as part of the process of tshuva, that I should look for the same conditions? After all, I can't acquire the title of being a Baal Tshuva Gemura, a master of complete tshuva, unless I'm under the identical conditions. Suppose the identical conditions never occur. They just don't happen. Then I don't get this title. So maybe in order to acquire this title of great praise, great success spiritually, I should put myself under those conditions and resist, and then I can acquire that great title. How does that idea strike you?
Not so smart.
Can you prove from the text that it's not so smart? This requires a little bit of extracurricular knowledge. What case are we talking about here? We're talking about illicit sexual relations. Right? Now, to be in the same condition as before, he's got to be isolated with her. Well, it just so happens that it's forbidden by halacha to be isolated with her.
Yeah.
Right? You're not allowed to be isolated with her.
So
the Rambam, following the Mishnah Yuma, is picking a case where you cannot reproduce the same conditions. You cannot. Now, it might happen. You know, you get into an 80-story building, and you get in the elevator, and you're reading your newspaper, people get in, getting out, you know, it's 30th floor, 40th floor, 50th floor, and then by 60th floor, people are thinning out, and between floors 71 and 72, it gets stuck. You feel the stop of the motion of the elevator, and you put down your newspaper, take a look around, and there she is. And there you are, stuck in the elevator. And it's one of the elevators doesn't have a camera, you know. And how did that happen? You know, okay, if God wants it to happen, he can arrange it. But you don't go looking for this. And since the Mishnah and the Rambam pick an example of this, it means whatever the idea of the title of Master of Complete Tshuva implies, it does not imply that you go looking for those conditions. That will cause us some trouble in understanding, but that's the bottom line. You don't go looking for those conditions. However, if the conditions occur, and this time the person refrains from the crime, he's called a master of complete tshuva. And then he quotes a verse from King Solomon, "Remember your Creator in the days of your youth," meaning you're still strong, you still love, and so forth and so on. And if he did not return from his crime until his older years, at a time when he cannot do what he did before. Now, I don't know whether he cannot do it because he's physically unable or emotionally unable or he's not psychologically driven to do it. At any rate, he can't reproduce the conditions of the crime. Even though his tshuva is not elevated, still, it accomplishes what tshuva does, which, as we will see, Mr. Shem, means wipes out your responsibility for the past, and he's called a Baal tshuva. He's a master of tshuva. Not complete tshuva, but tshuva. He's called a master of tshuva. He gets a title, a master, right? But not complete tshuva. That's level two. And now he says, even if he transgressed all his days. So you see, it's not just once, and then you're waiting for the tshuva to happen. No, this is habitual, and he does it over and over again. He transgressed all his days, and he did tshuva on the day of his death, and died with his tshuva intact. How long is that? 8 hours. Right? Did tshuva, and he retained the tshuva till the end, till he died. All of his transgressions are forgiven, wiped out. Nimcholim, wiped out. As it says, until the sun becomes dark and the light and the moon and the stars, the clouds cover everything. That's the day of death. From that verse, you see that if he remembered his creator and he returned, went back and didn't do the crime, returned from the position of doing the crime, whatever that is, before he died, he's forgiven. But notice here, he gets no title at all. Not a baal of anything. Not a master of anything. But he did it. So on the top level, where the conditions of the crime are reproduced and he resists, he's a baal tshuva gemura, a master of complete tshuva. If later, when he's older and can't do as he did before, but he's still a functioning person, then he's called a baal tshuva. And if it's on his deathbed, then he's credited with the action of doing tshuva, but a title, master, he doesn't get, but all of his transgressions are forgiven. Even that gesture just before death is enough to wipe out his responsibility for the past. What we will need to ask, and we'll see this after we go through the second halacha, is in what respect are we getting less and less here? What's becoming less and less spectacular, less and less of a performance, so that he goes down on levels, but still at the end, he's just under the line, you know, and he does the tshuva and he gets all the results of tshuva. Yeah.
Two questions. First is the second one. Is it only when you're older, or is that just to show if you can't exactly reproduce the situation?
My guess is that it's not just older. He's taking that as a general category. But if something would happen to a younger person and he can't reproduce it, then it would be the same thing. My guess is that's correct, yeah.
Okay, and second, third one, forgive me if I'm misunderstanding this, but it sounds decidedly Christian.
Okay, let me just take 30 seconds to put the position on the table here. Right? Judaism, Torah, is not anti-Christianity.
I'm just saying.
It's not anti-Christianity. The Christians might get something right. After all, they did take some of the material from us. So to hear an idea from our sources and to have it ring bells in your mind that sounds like Christianity, it might indeed sound like Christianity. They might have taken this from us and not distorted it. It could happen. The fact that it sounds Christian should not be a matter of interest as far as explaining our ideas or understanding our commentaries. If it sounds Christian, so much the better for them. You know, it means they got something right.
The other thing is, like, they can go do whatever they want, and at the end of the day, on their deathbed, you know, when they're leading the Nazi criminals out to the Nuremberg hangings, there's a priest walking with them saying, "Accept JC as your savior, and all your sins will be forgiven." And I can't rectify. I can't rectify.
That's a lot different. They don't actually have to do shiva.
No, they
could
do.
They could just say to somebody, "Say, you know, will you forgive me for these?" And the guy says, "Yes, you're forgiven."
You see, we haven't read the second halacha. You don't know what tshuva is. You don't know what tshuva is. Where do we get the definition of tshuva before we raise that question? Yeah.
To refer an eidman, of course, you know, in a broader sense, or maybe in a general sense rather. But isn't it all come down to intent? I mean, from a tshuva standpoint, it's your intent. It's supposed to, you know, doing it for the sake of doing it doesn't matter.
Well, let's see. Let's get the definition, because the definition will address this question. Let's get the definition of what tshuva is. We haven't seen that yet. We just talked about gradations of performance, but the basic definition we haven't seen yet. Okay. In the second halacha, we'll go back to the first halacha and analyze the things I'm leaving behind. But let's get the definition now. Umayi tshuva. Notice he starts with a vav. And what is tshuva? What is this tshuva? Meaning he knows very well. He left that over from the first halacha. Okay, well, I'll explain it. I myself raised that question, right? Okay. Who? It is that the transgressor shall abandon his transgression and remove it from his thought and decide in his heart, yigmur, a little more than decide. It means sort of commit himself, make up his mind in his heart, that he will not do it again. As it says, the wicked person shall abandon his way. Now, there are three verbs here, three ideas here, but since it's come under one verse, It's really three parts of one performance. I'll just repeat it before I analyze it. I'll go back through the whole thing. Then I'll go back again. This is abandoning. The verse says, Yaza Rosh Adarko, the wicked person should abandon his way. The Rama breaks it into three performances. Number one, the transgressor abandoned his sin. Number two, he pushes it out of his thoughts. And number three, he commits himself in his heart not to do it again. That's one idea. V'chein yisnachim, also he has to regret the past. He quotes another verse. Nichamti, I regret what I've done. Now comes a statement which in Hebrew is ambiguous, and we will work on this ambiguity. V'yo'ida alav yedeya ta'alumos. It either means he who knows the hidden will testify on him, or it means he will take the one who knows hidden things as his witness. They are different concepts, they mean different things, but at any rate, somewhere God is testifying, or taken as a witness, whatever it is, that he will not go back to that transgression forever. Quotes another verse. And thirdly, he has to verbally express these ideas in a confession. So, in general terms, there are three things here. To abandon the transgression, to regret what one has done, and to confess. This is abandoning is vis-a-vis the future. Person can hardly be said to have returned from his criminal activities if he's continuing to plan to do them. Just, you know, that's become his policy and he's maintaining his policy. He can't be said to be reforming himself from what he's done if he gives up the activity without regretting the failure. A person might give up the activity without regretting it for a variety of reasons. Boy, did I used to enjoy that, but now it's illegal and I'm afraid of going to jail. Or it raises my cholesterol, so I can't afford it anymore. Or, you know, my wife has come down on me, so I'm going to lose my marriage. That's not reforming. That certainly doesn't get a person credit. Doesn't get him forgiveness for his past transgressions. A serious reform has to have both elements. The commitment to change one's future behavior on the one hand, and also to regret what one has done in the past. And then, which is, I think, a considerable surprise, there's a third element of verbal confession without which the tshuva is not valid. There must be a verbal confession. Now, I will insert something here that we will talk about in some detail. I say it's not valid, but parts of tshuva do have an effect. It's not an all-or-nothing process. It's not an all-or-nothing process. I'll repeat, but just so to set your mind at ease. There are two types of mitzvos. Some mitzvos are all-or-nothing, and some are not. You wear tefillin. If one letter is missing, it's nothing. You don't get, say, well, let's see, there are 500 letters, so I got 499 500ths of tefillin. You got zero tefillin. One letter is missing, it's zero. Charity is a certain amount of money a person is supposed to give to charity. If he gives half, he did something, and he gets credit for it, just that he didn't do the rest. Tshuva is like charity. However much you do, however many parts you do, to whatever degree you do it, you get credit for it. Only to get full credit, full effect, you have to have all three parts. One part is abandoning the behavior, a little more of that as we'll see. The other is regretting, and the third is confession. And confession is necessary to have done the full tshuva. Yeah.
Yeah.
The confession is a confession to God.
Okay.
And we have that confession three times a day in our regular prayers, and then there are special penitential prayers, and strictly speaking, you can do it any time.
That would be a fundamental difference between Judaism and Christianity.
Okay, the Rambam brings it in the third paragraph about what when you have to confess to individuals or not to individuals. There's a big discussion of that, but usually it would be to the person that you wronged. And then the question would be whether it's in public also. It's a long discussion thing. But the essential confession is to God. Yeah.
The example always says the evil person, obviously it's also referring to things of like kind of not an evil agent, like kosher, kashrut.
Wait a minute. I didn't use the phrase evil person.
Well, I don't know. What's the other word? Is some
yeah, it's a Rosh Hadar code. That's in the verse. Yeah, but now let's get straight. Any commandment from God has to be kept. Violating any commandment from God, violating any commandment from God, qualifies a person as a criminal. Yeah, qualifies him as a criminal. If he does it deliberately and high-handedly, it makes no difference whether it's interpersonal or it's not interpersonal. If he knows that God wants him to keep kashrut, and he thumbs his nose at God and says, I like cheeseburgers, too bad for you, he's a wicked person, correct.
Maybe he wasn't educated.
Then he could have that with charity too. Maybe he doesn't know he has to give charity.
Right.
No, that makes no difference. The fact that it's interpersonal or it's what people call ritual makes no difference whatsoever. There's a creator, and the creator said to do it. Anybody who violates it qualifies the person, if he does it deliberately in full knowledge, he qualifies as a person who's wicked. It makes no difference whether it involves another person or not. It involves the creator of the universe who told you what he wants you to do.
So the second part of the question. So, if the person didn't learn it?
Then he doesn't know, but that's true for charity also.
But he's still considered a wicked person?
No, but that's true for charity also. It has nothing to do whether it's interpersonal. Don't make that mistake. Interpersonal charity and kashrus are strictly on a par. The creator of the universe wants both. Anybody who knowingly violates either one of them is wicked, and doesn't. And if he's unknowingly, then he's not wicked on either of them. There's no difference in principle here between interpersonal transgressions and what are so-called ritual transgressions. There's no difference whatsoever. That's not a distinction. Okay, I'm not commenting on people's psychology and counseling and whether it's a good idea. That's not, I'm learning the Rambam here, right? I'm not commenting. I don't know who he was. I don't know what his conditions were. I have no business to comment on that. That's not my business.
Your definition of wicked is not doing what God wills, basically, is what you're saying.
Of course it is, but it's only a person who does it knowingly and deliberately that qualifies as wicked.
No, what if they don't put the film on because you were lazy? Is that
good, then you know it.
Evil?
Correct. Of course, you know that God wants you to do it, and you say, no, I'm lazy. Excuse me. Now, of course, there are levels in this. There are levels in this term. There are levels of this term, right? There's more and less. There's more significant and less significant. But a person who says to God, I know what you want, but I'm not interested, that person qualifies for a condemnation. But only a person who knows is obligated, right? If he doesn't know about that, then he doesn't know that he's obligated. I mean, it goes on and on and on.
So yeah. If somebody, let's say your command is to do grace after milk, right?
Yeah.
Now let's say that you can't do this because they've only got siddurs in Hebrew.
Okay, it's only when you deliberately and knowingly do it. They're not deliberate. You can't help it. There, you can't help it.
But you can do it when you get to an English siddur. Still don't do, and you're available to do it.
Yeah, well, of course. Right. Okay, let's go back to a little more detail. The first of the three is reforming your future. Now he says, this first of the three components has itself three items under it, three sub clauses. He abandons the crime. That means that he doesn't do it. He pushes it out of his thoughts. It's not enough. It's not enough to dwell on it mentally, to think about it, to pine away for it, to desire it, but then when the opportunity comes up to muster the courage to say no. That guy insulted me in public. Boy, would I like to pop him one. I really would like to pop. Okay, I don't do that. I'm a civilized person, you know. Maybe I look to him to insult him, maybe. But I'm not gonna hit him. I'm not gonna hit him, right? But boy, would I like to. And I sort of dwell on it and think, wow, boy, if I just knock him down, look at that. Oh, would that be good? You know. I say, ah. But no, I'm not gonna do it. That's not enough. You have to push it out of your thoughts. It's a big requirement now. It's not enough just to resolve not to do it. It's to push it out of your thoughts. And
it's so hard just to not act on that, you know?
Now you're going to, you're learning already what you said 6 minutes ago was wrong, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And furthermore, he says, Yigmor Balibo Sholiasehu. Here it means there's a commitment in the heart. That, I think, it goes a little step further. You know, I don't do that sort of thing. I'm not going to do that sort of thing. I'm committed not to doing that sort of thing. How can I guarantee that I won't fail? That might require some strategy. That might require some planning. Indeed, going back to what we said in the first halacha, that you don't put yourself under the conditions of the prior transgression. So Salanta said, worldly wisdom, wisdom of the world is how to know to stay away from compromising circumstances. So for example, in terms of the case we thought about, maybe one shouldn't read the newspaper in the elevator, but one should keep an eye on who's getting in, who's getting out. And if you see that person get in, then you get out. Don't take a chance on getting caught in an elevator, it'll get stuck. Okay, maybe that's a little exaggeration, but my point is that Yigmar Balibo means I've taken it on now as a life project. I'm not getting caught like this anymore. So it's not enough that I've made up my mind not to do it, it's more that I undertake to plan my life in such a way that I'm not going to get caught by this anymore. This is the thoroughness with which he has to abandon that crime. He says, I'm not going to do it, and he puts it out of his mind, and he creates strategies to make sure that he won't be under compromising circumstances which could lead him to fail. That's the first category. Let me get through it, and then I'll take a question. Then he says he has to regret. And I pointed out to you that a person could stop doing something without any regret at all. Regret means that you probably have all experienced this, that sinking feeling in your stomach. Oi, what did I do? If only I could go back. If only I could go back and do it again, I would do it differently. I wouldn't do it like that. It was terrible what I did. I shouldn't have done it. Now, this element of regret also applies to what you said before. Imagine a person who thinks of the following strategy. It says at the end of the first halacha that even on your deathbed you can do tshuva. What a great deal. What a great deal. Listen carefully. This is what he says. I have a whole lifetime to do as I please. Of course, he's got to assume that he knows when he's going to die. People do get caught by unexpectedly and die, but he's taking that chance. I'm going to have a whole lifetime to do as I please, and then in the last 2 hours, I'll do tshuva. Listen carefully. He's planning this. This is his plan. Well, now, but let's think. One of the things he'll have to do in those last 2 hours is regret what he did. Oi, it was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. I made a mistake. I wish I could do it over again because it was wrong. But look, when he's making the plan now, he thinks it's a perfectly satisfactory plan. He thinks it's smart. He thinks it's perfectly valid. How can he now choose to do something which he judges to be perfectly valid and then plan at the end to regret it and say, I wish I hadn't done it? Why should he wish he hadn't done it? On the contrary, it was very smart, it was very clever, and it was perfectly valid. Here you have an inconsistent point of view. You can't now decide to do something with the perfect confidence that it's a good decision, where part of the decision is that you're planning later to regret what you're doing and say that it was a mistake. That's not a coherent state of mind. So this idea that you'll do it now and plan to do tshuva later, and using tshuva later as a way to justify what you're doing now, is an incoherent state of mind. That doesn't mean that not. I mean, there are people with incoherent states of mind. But a person who thinks it through clearly can't tolerate that state of mind because he can't plan to regret and then on the basis of planning to regret say that now the decision is perfectly justified. That's not coherent. Okay. Now the Rambam says these words. And I told you that's ambiguous. He who knows hidden things, ta'alumos are hidden things, should yo'id on him that he'll never go back to that transgression. Two ways to read it. One way to read it is God will testify. God will testify that he's never going back to that transgression. The difficulty with that translation, as the Kesef Mishnah points out, the Lechem Mishnah points out, is that it seems to interfere with free will. If God is going to testify at that moment that he'll never go back to that transgression, and God's testimony presumably is infallible, then it's not easy to see how he has free will later to transgress. And therefore, the Kesef Mishnah suggests that we read it, because it's ambiguous, to read it as follows. That he takes God as his witness that he will never go back to it. Now, what does that mean? He's like this. The person says, I'm not doing that again. I'm committed. Yigmor belibo. He's committed himself in his heart not to do it again. Now, when he takes God as his witness, you can only take God as your witness for what you are now. You can't take God as a witness for what you are tomorrow. You're taking him as your witness. Listen, I'm saying this, and God is my witness that I'm sincere. I mean it. It's really true. So this, he'll not go back to the transgression ever again, is a statement about his commitment. He's saying, I take God as my witness that I really mean it. But no more than that. It's not that God testifies about what he will do in the future. It's that God testifies that his commitment now is a sincere commitment, an honest commitment that he'll never go back to it. And that's all that's required. All that's required is that at this minute, he has sincerely and honestly committed himself not to go back to it. No more than that. So, he's made up his mind not to do it, and he's pushed it out of his thoughts, and he's regretted what he's done in the past, and he has taken God as his witness that he really means it. All of this leaves room for future failure. This is an extremely important principle. Temporary tshuva is valid tshuva. Temporary tshuva is valid tshuva. Wow is right. This is extremely important. Temporary tshuva is valid tshuva. A person can sincerely go through all of these steps, including confession, of course, and later be subject to recidivism, you know, go back to the old failures, and it does not wipe out his tshuva. It doesn't remove the tshuva. It doesn't remove the effects of the tshuva. It's a new slate. It's a new slate with new failures, but does not reinstate the old failures. Let me explain this to you, and let me prove this to you, and then we'll discuss it, because this is very important to get straight on. Logically, I'd like to do the proof first and the explanation second, but I think pedagogically it would be better this way. Let's think what tshuva means. A person does something wrong over a period of time, habitually, and then tshuva tells us that he can change. He can really change. And that real change, that real improvement, that real reformation in his character leads God to forgive him for what he's done in the past. Now, if a person can really change and improve, he can also really change and deteriorate. Both changes are real. If you can really improve, then you can really deteriorate. So, let's say it's Yom Kippur, and he does tshuva, really, sincerely, and then in May, he slips and fails again. Why should I think that his failure in May somehow retroactively invalidates the tshuva he did in October? Both are true. Both are correct. Both are real. He really improved in October, and he really deteriorated in May. Temporary tshuva is valid tshuva. So says the Meiri in his Chibur al HaTshuva, which is a famous, gigantic work on tshuva. And so says the Pri Tzadik, and the Pri Tzadik proves it from a famous case in the Gemara. And I'll share this with you because it's a very interesting idea. Here you have to use your logic a little bit. A man says to a woman, Hari at mikudeshesli, behold, we should be married. Amanash sheni tzadik gomer, on the condition that I am perfectly righteous. And she says, okay. I mean, you can't force anything out of a woman, but she says, okay. Good. Then the Gemara says, Afilu Rasha Gomer Kol Yomav. Even if he was perfectly wicked up until that minute, they are at least possibly married, because maybe he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart at that minute. Again, he says to her, we should be married on condition that I am a perfectly righteous person. She says yes. The Gemara says they may be married, even though he was perfectly wicked up until that minute. They might be married because he might have had thoughts of tshuva in his heart at that moment. Now, here's the question. How does he behave after that minute? When they walk out from under the chuppah, how does he behave? Can you deduce from the conditions I gave you how he behaves? Can you deduce that he behaves well? Can you deduce that he behaves ill? Or perhaps you can't deduce anything at all. That's the question. Which of the, A, B, or C? Again, he says we should be married on condition that I'm perfectly righteous. Even if he's perfectly wicked up until that moment, maybe they're married because maybe he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart at that moment. From that description, can you deduce about his subsequent behavior, his later behavior, that he behaves righteously? Can you deduce that he behaves wickedly? Or can you perhaps deduce nothing at all? What is the correct answer? Okay, how many in favor of nothing at all? Okay, that's a substantial plurality at least. How many in favor of deducing that he behaves well? Nobody. One. Okay, how many in favor of deducing that he behaves ill? One. Okay, he's the only one who got it right.
He's the lawyer.
Okay, how did you deduce it?
Because he came in with a statement that I've done something wrong already.
So how do you know he continues to behave ill? Okay.
Which is worse than having the right answer.
Correct, quite correct. Now, let's think. He behaved wickedly up until that minute. And then he says what he says. And the Gemara says, now listen carefully, the Gemara says, maybe they're married. Maybe they're married. Maybe. Because maybe he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart at that moment. Maybe. Maybe means?
Maybe.
Means we don't know. Means looking at him, we don't know. Only maybe. It's possible, but we don't know. Now, why don't we know? Not at all. Why don't we know? No. Imagine that he walks into the chuppah Al Capone, and he walks out Albert Schweitzer. Right? Wouldn't you know that he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart? He walked out a different person. His behavior entirely has changed. Right? Of course you would know that he had it. The only way that you cannot know what he has in his heart is if his behavior continues wicked. He's wicked before, he's wicked afterwards. And then we say, okay, his behavior is wicked. But maybe, since I can't look into his mind, maybe in spite of the fact that his behavior continues to be wicked, at that moment he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart. Says the Preet Tzaddik, you can deduce from this case that he must have continued to behave badly. And yet the Gemara says, maybe he had tshuva in his heart. Think carefully, watch carefully now. Maybe he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart. And then he qualifies for the condition that he set up for himself, that I'm perfectly righteous. So you see that momentary resolve to be righteous qualifies him at that moment as perfectly righteous. Okay? Now, strictly speaking, see if anybody's paying attention, go back about 9 minutes. Strictly speaking, we don't have tshuva here. Why not?
Because you can't laugh.
Think. Simple, simple, simple. Don't go in, don't off on a...
You can't go back in.
No. Why doesn't he have tshuva here? Right, he didn't confess. You need three elements for tshuva to be complete. You've got to accept the future, regret the past, and confess. And the confession isn't here, right? We didn't see that. Good. So the Preet Tzaddik is like this. The Gemara only says that he qualifies for the title of perfect tzaddik. Perfect tzaddik means your character, your motivations, your goals, your aspirations. Now, you might have a terrible history. But the thought of reform is enough to qualify you as a reformed person now. That doesn't wipe out your history. Tshuva wipes out your history. If you don't confess, then you don't have the full performance of tshuva, and your history remains history. You have an evil history. And right now, you qualify as a righteous person. Righteous person is not a historical concept. It's a momentary concept. What kind of person are you now? At any rate, that's the pre-tzaddik's proof that temporary tshuva works from that Gemara. I mean, here he says the Chibur al-Tshuva. Also, the Rambam here, according to the way the Kesef Mishnah tells us to read it, the Rambam is definitely implying that, because all you need is resolve. Resolve and decision and regret, which are all a momentary state of mind, that's enough to qualify as having done tshuva. As the Baal HaTanya says, when we say Chanun HaMar B'Lisloach, God, Mar B'Lisloach, Mar means to multiply, to expand forgiveness. He says it refers to performing the same transgression over and over again, the same transgression over and over again, and being forgiven over again and over again and over again. God doesn't run out of patience. He doesn't run out of acceptance. Person does shuv. So therefore, it comes to Yom Kippur. Person says, so many Yom Kippurim have gone by, and each day, each time I tried, and every time later on I failed, should not give up hope. It has a real effect. It wipes out the previous year, and then one starts with a new slate, and one tries to do one's best in the coming year. Yeah.
What if you don't believe something that you may know?
Say again, you don't what?
You don't believe it. Like, someone told you something, like, maybe for whatever reason you just don't believe it. It's a mitzvah. You don't believe it.
Okay, so it depends on whether you should have believed it, shouldn't have believed it. I don't know. Listen, you know, there are gray areas in every concept, and the questions about gray areas are endless. They're interesting, but I'm coming to lay down the fundamentals now, and I want to how to answer the question, as I say, you can multiply questions about gray areas indefinitely. Yeah. You have to do separate tshuva for each one that you at least remember and know, and confess it separately. And then there's a statement in the general confession which says, "I know there are lots of things that I've forgotten about." And now you see people davening on Yom Kippur, and you see them standing there for half an hour, three quarters of an hour, or an hour. These are very conscientious people. The people, the Gaon of Vilna used to keep a little notebook, and every year. And Yom Kippur used to open it up and cry. No, it was for the sake of Yom Kippur. He said, dedicated for Yom Kippur. And one year he cried excessively, and as Jewish disciples would do, they got hold of it and looked at it, and they saw that he was looking at the entry for minutes wasted per year. Right? And that year the entry said 7. And he was crying over those 7 lost minutes, right? So, okay, so we're all on different levels, and we all have different responsibilities, right? You know, if I could not waste 7 minutes per hour, I'm very happy. Anyway, this is the groundwork of what tshuva requires. Yeah.
So, going to the idea of Yom Kippur and the idea of no tshuva is a wasted tshuva, even though we may transgress our vow to not do the transgression ever again. We transgress that vow during the year. Is that why this whole annulment of vow section is open in Yom Kippur?
There's no vows on Yom Kippur. When you say to God that you're not going to do it again, that's not count as a vow. No, it is not a vow, and the person should always, any statement that he makes, have in mind that it's not meant as a vow, and that annulment that you have in Erev Rosh Hashanah, that annulment of vows is meant for any time in the future when I'll make a statement, I won't remember to think or say that it shouldn't be a vow. It shouldn't be a vow. It's to nullify them retroactively and pro. That's right. You should never make a vow. Under any condition, many people lost tremendous sums of money because they weren't willing to take an oath in court. And it's certainly not a vow. Yom Kippur is not a vow. Nothing to do with that. Furthermore, a vow concerning a mitzvah in general is not valid because you're already bound by God from Sinai, so it's invalid altogether. It doesn't add any more responsibility to what God already told you to do. So
how do we explain transgressing something we already did to you before? Like, God's going to just be like, well, I understand the first time, but what's wrong with you?
Well, I don't think that's right. First of all, King Solomon said, Shevi Yipol Tzadik V'Kam, the righteous person falls 7 times and gets up. Now, there are people who face problems in life, difficult problems, and sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. I think we give them credit for the times they succeed, even if they fail again later. Right? We don't expect perfect performance from a person. And each person, the person says, you know, this person gets angry, or he wastes money, or he, you know, whatever it is. Sometimes he succeeds in overcoming it, sometimes he doesn't. We certainly give him credit for every time he succeeds. When I say, well, you're going to fail next month, so it's not worth anything. No, every success is a success. Yeah. Well, that's true. That's quite true. But it makes a big difference what it is you do from the heart.
He's saying...
One second. It makes a big difference what you do from the heart. You have certain responsibilities from the heart. You know, a man who misses his wife's birthday says, I don't bear you any ill will. I love you and so forth and so on. I just forgot. Sorry, but you should have remembered, right? So, you know, your heart has to be instructed by your mind. Now, let's just finish one more thing before we run out of time in the hour. Let's go back to the first halacha. There were three gradations. There were three gradations, right? The guy who underwent the same circumstances and succeeded in refraining. The guy in his older age, when he couldn't do what he did before, but he did tshuva. And the guy did tshuva on his deathbed. And they are less and less significant. Why? Which of the dimensions of tshuva is being reduced here? You have less and less of it, and because you have less and less of it, it's less and less of a performance. We had three dimensions of tshuva. Which dimension is being reduced in going from A to B to C here?
From the opportunity to not do it in the future.
Okay, opportunity is not quite right. Opportunity is not a description of a process of tshuva, but yeah. The commitment not to do it again. Here's a person who did the crime, is under the same circumstances, and refrains. That person's commitment not to do it again is gigantic, right? Person who's older and doesn't have the same strength, and he says either, what people call counterfactually, if I had the strength, I wouldn't do it. You know, he puts himself in a psychological state where if he had the strength, he would be able to overcome it, but he's not really facing it. And then you come to the person on his deathbed, I'll never do it again in the next 3 hours because that's all I've got. You know? So you'd say, oh, come on, give me a break. That's not serious. So the Rambam says, no, it is serious. And he quotes a verse for it. It is serious. And this introduces another general theme, which I mentioned to you 42 minutes ago. All right, for the recording, my use of the number of minutes is meant as humorous. that in tshuva, when you do everything that you can, you get credit for it. Even if it isn't the pristine, original definition, if you are in reduced circumstance, if you do everything that you can, you get credit for it. You're not disqualified because it becomes impossible. The famous example is if you steal something from somebody, you got to give it back. Suppose he disappears and you can't give it back. Well, you should, but if you can't give it back, that doesn't stop your tshuva. If you can give it back and you don't, that does stop your tshuva. But if you can't give it back anymore because he's disappeared, then it doesn't stop your tshuva. No, he's gone. He's gone. Disappeared. Not it is disappeared. He's disappeared.
He jumped out.
People do disappear, as I'm sure you're aware. Yeah. It's a whole industry. Okay, tomorrow we'll continue, Ms. Hashem.
One quick question. What happens if, because you were saying how somebody is deemed to be wicked if they know they should be doing something and yet they are blatantly not doing it. Now, what happens if, let's say, for